Okay, well, I hope you have a good weekend.
Thank you.
So we're talking about spin dynamics, the icing model, or easing model. Today, I'm either going to finish or I should finish what I'd like to talk about. So let me just remind you some things that we derived from previous lectures. Under the assumption of single spin flip dynamics, and under the assumption of detailed balance, we derive the rate at which a given spin I, right, spin will flip. And so sigma prime is the state that's derived from sigma I when I spin flips. And so to make the notation compact, I'll just call this W sub I, the probability, the rate at which the I spin flips. And using detailed balance, we derive that this flip rate has this functional form, 1/2 1 minus sigma I, where sigma I, so there's a slight change in notation, because sometimes, I think last lecture, I used F sub I. And here, I'm using sigma sub I, you'll see why in a moment. So sigma sub I is a variable that can either equal plus 1 or minus 1, refer to the actual value spin on the I side. And so the flip rate is nothing more than 1/2 1 minus sigma I, hyperbolic tangent of the effective field that is felt by the spin at the I site. So in the case of an easing model with interaction between sites I and site j, with an interaction strength j sub ij, that effective field is just the sum of the spin variables times the coupling strength and the summing up over all neighbors. That gives me my effective field, and that's the flip rate.
Okay. So anyway, so that was our flip rate. And the crucial feature about this flip rate is, first of all, the amplitude on front is arbitrary, and we can choose it to be anything we want. And this particular choice is done in such a way that this thing will go to 1 if sigma I is sigma sub I is parallel to the effective field for, make this legible, or beta going to infinity. So at very low temperature, if you're aligned with the field, then there's no reason to flip because all your neighbors are in sync with you, and so there's no reason to flip because that would correspond to raising the energy. On the other hand, this will go to approach 1 if sigma I is anti-parallel to H effective or beta going to infinity. So the flip rate sort of accords with your natural intuition, which is that if all of my neighbors are pointing in the same direction as I am, I have very little impetus to try and flip my spin because it corresponds to raising my local energy. On the other hand, if all of my neighbors are pointing opposite to me, then it behooves me to flip my spin or flip myself because that means I will lower my energy. And so what we saw is that the rate at which the spin changes, and so here SI represents a thermal average of the variable sigma, sigma sub I. And we saw that when you take a spin and ask, like, how does it change as a function of time? So when I flip a spin, if I'm plus 1, I go to minus 1, which means a change of minus 2. If I'm minus 1 and I flip, I go to plus 1, which is also a change of minus 2. That's why there's a minus sign and a 2. This is the magnitude of the change in the spin variable. And this is times the rate at which you flip. And so this gives me the time derivative of S. And so from that, we first looked at the complete graph. And what we derived last time was the following equation for the magnetization, which is equal to minus M plus H beta M. And we saw that this equation could have either one solution or three solutions depending on the value of beta. And so for beta less than 1, which corresponds to T greater than the critical temperature, which is equal to 1, there's one solution. And for beta larger than 1, which corresponds to T below the critical temperature, which equals 1 in the units that we choose for the complete graph, there are three solutions. And here the one solution is just M equals 0. Here the three solutions are M equals 0 and then plus or minus the equilibrium value of m. And so I guess this is where I ended last time. And so now the only other thing I want to do is actually solve this equation in these limiting cases. So for beta less than 1, then the point is that if I plot as a function of m dot, it's a function which looks something like this. It's a cubic curve near the origin. It looks something like this. And the crucial point is that for m negative, m dot is positive, which means I'm being driven to the right. And if m dot is positive, I'm sorry, if m is positive, m dot is negative, and I'm being driven to the left. And so this is the stable fixed point. And near the fixed point, we can understand the nature of the solution by looking very close to the fixed point, in which case we can replace the full curve by its tangent. And so we just have a linear curve here. So we just expand our equation near m equals 0. And so we'll get m dot is approximately equal to minus m plus beta m. And I can neglect higher order terms. So this is equal to minus m 1 minus beta. Since beta is less than 1, this is a positive number. And so this is just exponential decay. So from this, we infer that m of t asymptotically scales as e to the minus t over tau, where the characteristic time scale of this decay is 1 divided by 1 minus beta. So very quickly, you're driven to m equals 0. For beta equals 1, so in this case, our curve comes in with 0 slope. So it looks something like this. M dot as a function of m. And in this particular case, we need to keep the cubic term when we expand the hyperbolic tangent because the linear term vanishes. And here we get m dot is approximately equal to minus 1/3 m cubed. And so the solution to this, well, again, you know, you can solve the differential equation, but you know, in this instance, it's really useful to use dimensional analysis. This is units of m over t. This is units of m cubed. So I cancel 1 power of m on both sides. I get m squared is 1 over t. M goes like 1 over the square root of t. So asymptotically, the right answer is m of t scales like 1 over the square root of t. So very slow decay at the critical temperature. And this feature that the dynamics slows down when you approach the critical temperature is what's called critical slowing down. And it's a typical feature of relaxation of spin systems in that when you try and relax to the critical point, things slow down quite dramatically. And then the last point is when beta is larger than 1, below the critical temperature. In this case, if I plot m dot as a function of m, we had a curve that looked something like this. And again, before we try and do any calculation, it's useful just to like intuit what we expect just from the flow diagram. And you see that over here, if m is somewhere to the left of this point, then m dot is positive, which means that I'm driven to the right. So I'm driven to the right, driven to the right. If m is in this range, then m dot is negative, and so I'm driven to the left, so I'm driven this away. So this is a stable fixed point, and this corresponds to the minus m equilibrium. Similarly, this point, where again the slope is negative at the fixed point, is a stable fixed point, and this corresponds to positive m equilibrium. And you see there's another fixed point here where if I just start infinitesimally away from it, I'm driven away from the fixed point. So this is an unstable fixed point. So unless you start exactly at m equals 0, you're either driven to positive m equilibrium or negative m equilibrium. And you know, again, you can't solve this equation exactly because this is a transcendental equation. But if you just want the long-time behavior, all you have to do is say, well, let's look infinitesimally close around each fixed point. And around each fixed point, you see that there's going to be a tangent. And you know, I mean, my drawing is kind of crappy because the slope should be the same at both fixed points because they're like obviously identical by symmetry. And so The point is that the behavior here is essentially the same as the behavior here. There's a linear slope, and close to the fixed point, you can write an equation not for m as a function of time, but the deviation of m from the equilibrium value. And so here, I have just enough space to do it. So let me just put it over here. So in this particular case, you're going to get, you know, m minus m equilibrium, absolute value, this object, dot. So let me define just delta m is equal to m minus m equilibrium, absolute value, and the whole thing, absolute value. So basically, delta m dot, the deviation, is equal to minus delta m times beta minus 1. You can, you know, just if you do the expansion yourself, that's obviously what you're going to have to get, because it's linear, because it comes in with a linear slope. And the coefficient is now beta minus 1. And so it says that the deviation of the magnetization from the, the rate at which the magnetization or the deviation goes to 0 is the same as this one, but with their characteristic time scale, which is now beta minus 1. So from here, I would get that delta m of t, the deviation from the equilibrium value, scales as e to the minus t over tau, just as before. But now tau is equal to 1 over beta minus 1. And that is the complete graph solution of the dynamical Ising model. So any questions with this story?
Wait, sorry. How do you get from delta m equals m minus m eq to delta m dot? Is that what is the m equilibrium, and how come it doesn't factor in if we have the absolute value?
Well, no. So the m equilibrium are these points here.
Yeah.
And all I'm trying to argue is that, you know, I'm not, you know, if you really want to solve carefully, you'll see after a lot of work that what I said is clearly correct. The point is that near the equilibrium point, the curve m dot is a function of m, it has a linear slope. And if I only want to look at the dynamics in the very long time limit, all I care about is what happens just in this very small region about the fixed point. And so it's the same equation as what we had here. It clearly must be that the deviation of m from the equilibrium value is linear in the deviation.
Okay.
And that's all there is to it. Okay. So, all right. So I want to now turn to the one-dimensional Ising model. And here, I hope you'll come to appreciate just how pretty the solution is and how it has a very nice geometrical interpretation. So let's write down the flip rate of the one-dimensional Ising model. And so let me write W sub I. And so I go to my general formula over here. And so I have 1 half 1 minus sigma I. And now let me make a request. Stop writing for 20 seconds, because I'm going to do something a little sleazy here. So I'm going to write here tanh beta j. And then I have the summation over the neighbors. And so there's going to be sigma I minus 1 is one of the neighbors of sigma I, plus sigma I plus 1. And now I'm going to do something a little sleazy, but not that sleazy, which is I'm going to divide by 2 and multiply by 2. So now you can start writing again. But I just wanted to put the 2 here after the fact. OK, and so let me now define this object here, which is just some number. Let's call this gamma. So that's just what the conventional notation. And so this becomes 1 half 1 minus, let me do one more thing here. Sorry. Let's now look at this object over here. What is this? Well, sigma I can take the values plus 1 or minus 1. And so this object can take 3 possible values. This thing can either be plus 1, minus 1, or it could be 0. But it's inside the argument of hyperbolic, and this is tanh, not tan, hyperbolic tanh. Right? Yeah, it's tanh over here, hyperbolic tanh. So again, I'll use the trick that because the hyperbolic tanh is an odd function of its argument, so tanh of something times 1 is just the tanh of the function. Tanh of something times minus 1 is minus the tanh, and tanh of something times 0 is 0. So that means that I can actually factor this object out in front. And so this now becomes 1 minus sigma I minus 1 plus sigma I plus 1 over 2, and then times gamma, 1 minus gamma. And so this looks a lot simpler because it looks very algebraic, and it just involves the sigma i's with some coefficient here. So this is the flip rate of the one-dimensional easing model. And to give you a geometrical feeling for, like, what does this formula actually mean, cheap chalk, let's look at the limit of beta going to 0. Beta going to infinity, that's 0 temperature. That means t going to 0, which implies that gamma, which is tanh beta j, is equal to 1. Let's look what happens then. And so in this limit of gamma equal, yeah?
I have a question about taking out that thing. But isn't there also beta j in the argument?
No, the beta j, yeah, that was here. This whole thing, this is tanh.
Yeah, so like how can you take out part of it?
Because again, what I'm saying is that I have, like, you know, tanh of like a binary variable, b sub I times x. And this, I argue, is equal to b sub I tanh x.
Ah, okay. Yeah, never mind.
That's all. Okay. Well, my brushes have migrated. Okay, anyway. So look, in the limit when gamma is equal to 1, so wi, what is it equal to? So there's several possibilities. If all of my spins, if I and my spin I, my two neighbors, are in agreement with me, so if I have the case, I guess let's do it this way. Let's do, if I have this situation, w, so here I am I, everybody's in agreement with me. So if I'm plus 1, and these guys are both plus 1, so 1 plus 1 is 2, divided by 2 is 1, 1, gamma is 1, so I have 1 minus 1, 0. So wi is equal to 0. On the other hand, if I am a downspin and my neighbors are both pointing up, then all that happens here is that it flips a sign, and so I'll get 1 plus 1 divided by 2, and so wi is equal to 1. And if, for example, my two neighbors are opposite to each other, and here I am, either spin up or spin down, it doesn't matter, I, well, in that case, sigma I plus 1 plus sigma I minus 1 adds to 0, and so I have tanh of 0, so all of this goes away, and I just have 1 half. So my flip rate is equal to 1 half. And now let's try and give this a geometrical interpretation, because you see, in this region where these spins are unhappy, there's something bad happening here because, you know, I disagree with you and that's bad. There's lots of friction, whatever. So let us denote that by a little particle. We'll call this defect particle or a domain wall particle. It turns out to be the elementary excitation of the one-dimensional easing model. So because these two guys disagree and these two guys disagree, there is a defect here. And the point is that because the flip rate is equal to 1, this automatically goes to this, 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 which means that the two domain wall particles have annihilated. So we can think of this process as, if I think of my particles as particles of type A, it's the reaction A plus A going to annihilation, nothing. Particle, antiparticle annihilation, except here the particle and antiparticle are essentially the same. In this case, well, there's no defect here, but there was a defect here. And so half of the time, I will flip. And so with probably 1 half, or rate 1 half, it'll go to this configuration. Whoops. This is down. It goes to this configuration. And all that's happened is that my domain wall particle has hopped one side to the left. So this corresponds to diffusion. And over here, well, nothing happened. And so we just went to everybody up. And so nothing happened. But now I can say, what happens if gamma is slightly less than 1, or less than 1 altogether? Well, if gamma is less than 1, so let's cross this out for a moment and put in here gamma less than 1. That means that instead of having 0 as a flip rate, I'll have something which is slightly larger than 0. And if it flips, then what happens here is that I have pair creation. So this corresponds to 0 going to a plus a. And then these flip rates, well, this will be a little bit less than 1. This will be a little bit different than 1/2. But the point is that at non-zero temperature, one can think of the dynamics of the spins in the Ising model as the chemical reaction of particle, antiparticle, annihilation with creation in one dimension. And at zero temperature is nothing more than particle, particle annihilation. And it turns out that if you can solve one, you solve the other. That's one thing. And there's lots of beautiful insights that go between the two types of pictures of what's happening in this one-dimensional Ising model. So I just, yes?
Does this, like if the particle and the antiparticle here are the same, that would be like a, that'd be like a Majorana particle?
Yeah.
And does that like carry through any more insight into the problem?
Well, I mean, again, this is purely classical dynamics. I mean, there's no, you know, there's nothing else quantum about the problem, except for the fact that the particle is its own antiparticle. But I mean, certainly one can look at problems where you have particle, the antiparticle being different than the particle in this formulation, then you get, you know, interesting dynamics as well. Okay, so what I want to do now, though, is let's continue our program of trying to solve for the dynamics of the Ising model by looking at the equation for the average spin. Oh, that doesn't show up very well. So we just have our equation, the Si by dt is equal to minus 2 sigma I wi. So let's see what that is. So we have minus 2, and then I have, so I have to multiply the flip rate by sigma I. So let's just multiply through by sigma I here. And so we're going to have 1/2, leading 1/2, and then I have sigma I. So I multiply sigma I with a 1 just gives me sigma I, and then I have minus gamma over 2, and then I multiply sigma I by sigma I, and I get 1, because the square of a spin, a binary spin variable is definite, is 1. And so I'm just left with the remainder in the brackets, sigma I minus 1 plus sigma I plus 1. Yeah, okay. And then I have to take the thermal average of this. And so what is this? So 2.5, so I get minus Si from that guy. And then here I have minus plus, ah, crap. I feel badly for Francois because all he's going to inherit is like broken chalk. So that there's 2 and 2 and, okay, there's gamma over 2. Si minus 1 plus Si plus 1. So this is Si dot. That's our equation of motion. And notice, this sort of looks like the random walk equation of motion, because the time rate of change, and if I think of Si as a probability being at site I, there's a rate at which I hop out, there's the loss, but then there's gain from Si minus 1 and Si plus 1. Instead of it being, you know, like in the case of the random walk, we had a 2 here and we had a factor 1 here. So because there's this factor gamma here, it sort of messes up the random walk-like picture. But it turns out that the mathematics still goes through. And so we can actually solve exactly for Si as a function of time. And so let me write the answer. So if Si at t equals 0, the average value of the spin is equal to to delta I zero. So what does that mean? It means that I have my one-dimensional lattice. Every spin is prepared on average with zero average value, except the spin at the origin, which is pointing up. And then I'm asking, how does this configuration decay in the long time limit? So in that case, it turns out that this is equal to Si of t is equal to I sub I of gamma t e to the minus t. Clear as mud. Where again, I sub I is the modified Bessel function of the second kind of order I, and that's the answer. And you know, I don't expect anybody to have any intuition for this function, but let me just tell you what it looks like in the long time limit, because that's all that really matters. And as we're going to see, I wonder if you can, you can't do two at the same time. Too bad. That would have been fun. So for t going to infinity in the long time limit, there's two possibilities. If gamma is equal to 1, then it turns out that Si of t asymptotically scales as e to the minus t. Gamma less than 1, Si of t, oops, sorry. God dang it, all wrong. This is messed up. 1 over 2 pi gamma t. And this goes as Si of t scales as e to the minus 1 minus gamma t divided by square root of 2 pi gamma t. So the point is that above the critical temperature, this one spin that you've prepared pointing up, it decays away. Its average value decays away exponentially in time, so very quickly. Whereas that if you're at zero temperature, which corresponds to the critical point of the one-dimensional Ising model, the spin decays away as 1 over square root of t. And that's the solution for the average value of the spin in the one-dimensional Ising model. But there's a but about this, which is that, so what have we learned? And I'd say we've learned nothing. Because the reason we've learned nothing is that we know that in the one-dimensional Ising model, there's no order at zero, non-zero temperature. And so if we start with one spin up, we know the order is going to disappear. We know the rate at which the order disappears. But it doesn't sort of tell us anything about the spatial structure of the spins. It doesn't give us any insight. And it turns out that what we need to get deeper insight is to look at the two-spin correlation function. Or the two-point, like people, you do field theory, right? You've heard the word two-point function? Yeah, and like all field theorists, they always talk about the two-point function this, two-point function that. So yeah, we're going to look at the two-point correlation function, because it turns out that it provides much more insight into what's going on in the dynamics of the Ising model. So let me define GK. Well, actually, how do I want to do it? Si, sigma I, sigma j, average value, where I minus j is equal to k. So for two spins with your distance k apart, this is the two-point function. And I don't care whether, because it's like left-right symmetry, it doesn't matter if I is bigger than j or j is bigger than I. It's going to be the same thing. And so let's look at the two-point function. But before we do that, let's focus attention on a very special correlation function, which is G1, the near neighbor correlation function. So what is this? This is a sigma I plus 1, average value. And also notice that because my system is translationally invariant, I don't have to care what I is. It could be spin a million and a spin a million and one, or spin 3 and spin 4. It's all the same. And so that's why we're a little sloppy here about the I, what it is. It doesn't matter what it is. But like, what is this guy? And so notice that if sigma I and sigma I plus 1 are in agreement, then we'll get 1. And if they disagree, we'll get minus 1. And so I could write this in a different way. I could write this as the probability of having the two spins in agreement, this or that, times plus 1, plus probability that the two spins disagree with each other, or down up times minus one. Well, we've already seen before that one way we can represent when spins are in a disagreement is that there's a defect. There's a domain wall particle here. And so now let's suppose that the density of domain wall particles, let's call rho the density of domain walls. And so this guy, second term, is a probability, I mean, this is like proportional to the density of domain walls. And so here we're going to get, and here there's no domain wall, and the probability of no domain wall is 1 minus rho. So this thing is the same as 1 minus rho. That's the probability that there are no domain walls, times minus, times plus 1, plus rho times minus 1, which is equal to 1 minus 2 rho. So now we have something very useful, which is that the domain wall density is equal to 1 plus g over 2, 1 plus g1 over 2. So this, so in some sense, by looking at the pair correlation function, we learned something very useful, because the domain wall density is essentially a measure of how far we are away from the ground state of the system. And so as the system decays to the ground state, the domain wall density will gradually go down, and we can measure it by looking at this two-spin correlation function. So that's a geometrical interpretation of this two-point correlation function. All right, since I'm not a field theorist, I can't stand I'm going to put two-spin correlation function. Okay. All right, so now we want to, just as before, here I want to now compute the average value of the two-spin correlation function. So let's compute dg k by dt. And so according to what we have here, this is equal to minus 2. And so let's write this as sigma I, sigma j. But now, what is the rate at which this correlation function can change? Well, if I have these two spins, spin 3 and spin 75, and I change spin 103, well, that's not going to affect anything. The only way that this can change is if I take my spin 3 and spin 75, and I flip spin 3, or I flip spin 75. That's the only way the correlation function can change. So this will change at a rate that's proportional to the flip rate of the ith spin plus the flip rate of the jth spin. And so now you see like how you can generalize it to multi-point correlation functions if you want. Anyway, so let's work this out, because it turns out to be kind of a pleasant calculation. So we have 2 sigma I, sigma j, and then I have, so w sub I, that's going to be our 1 half so 1 half, where is it? 1 minus gamma over 2 sigma I minus 1 plus sigma I plus 1. That's Wi. And then Wj is plus 1 half 1 minus gamma over 2 sigma j sigma j minus 1 plus sigma j plus 1. And then the thermal average of everything here. Okay, so let's do one step of algebra and then maybe some pictures to try and resolve what all this stuff is. So we bring in the 2 sigma I, sigma j. And so here we just get the value sigma I, sigma j. And then here, sigma I will contract with the other sigma I here and give me 1. And then I have sigma j multiplying everything here. So this thing is going to equal, so I'm going to get minus sigma I, sigma j from the first term. Then I have plus gamma over 2. And then I have, so the sigma i's cancel, I have left with sigma j. So I have sigma j sigma I minus 1 plus sigma I plus 1. And then I have plus, minus, and so in the second term I have the same sigma I sigma j plus gamma over 2, and then here I have the sigma j contracts away and I'm left with sigma I. So sigma I sigma j minus 1 plus sigma j plus 1. And then the whole thing is thermal average. Now before we go any further, let's just draw a picture to try and sort of resolve this, because it's actually, it may look a bit intimidating, but it's actually extremely simple. The idea here is that if I look at my two sites, say there's site I and site j. So when I look at the terms that are sitting here, I have j, and it's contracting with either I plus 1, which is this term, or I minus 1, which is this term. So here is I minus 1. This is I plus 1. In this guy, I have I, which is contracting with either j minus 1 or j plus 1. So I is contracting either with j plus 1, so here's j plus 1, or it's contracting with j minus 1 over here. And because the system is translationally invariant, all that matters is the length of these segments, not like where they are on the line. And so we have two segments which are one less and two segments which are one larger. And so if you just put all that together, that what you're going to get then is GK dot is equal to, so I have minus 2GK from the first term, plus gamma GK minus 1 plus GK plus 1. So it looks essentially the same as the equation for the mean spin, except for an overall factor of 2. So it sort of say, it looks like, boy, we worked really hard and we got nothing out of it because all we did was just a factor of 2. But there's actually one crucial difference here that makes this equation actually useful. And why it's useful is the fact that we need some kind of an initial condition here, or boundary condition, I'm sorry. We need both an initial condition and a boundary condition. So the initial condition I'm going to choose is, let me assume that GK at t equals 0 is equal to delta k 0. That is that I'm assuming that my spins are all uncorrelated with each other, except I'm correlated perfectly with myself. So at x, at k equals 0, which is going to be sigma, you know, sigma 0, sigma 0, by definition, that's 1. So this thing is 0 except at k equals 0. And the other boundary condition I'm going to have is gk. G0 at any positive time. Well, if I'm correlated with myself now, I'm correlated with myself tomorrow. I'm still, you know, the sum of my squares and my spins are always 0. So this guy always has to equal 1. And it turns out that this boundary condition makes this equation actually useful. And so what I want to do now is show you how to solve this equation and see what we can learn from it.
What's the last condition there? G0, I didn't understand that.
Yeah, so the point is that, what is G0? G0 is your self-correlation. And if you have only two possible states, you know, you are, I don't know, plus 1 or minus 1, then if you take the square of that, that's going to always be plus 1, no matter if it's today, tomorrow, next year, whatever. Okay, so let's solve this. So it turns out that to solve this in the discrete case is kind of messy. And in fact, it was first done by Roy Glauber in 1965. He wrote a very beautiful paper called The Exact Solution of the One-Dimensional Ising Model. Have any of you heard the name Roy Glauber? No? Ising-Glauber dynamics? No? You've heard of him. So anyways, so Roy Glauber wrote this beautiful paper in Journal of Mathematical Physics where he solved it in the discrete case. And I'm not going to present that because it's very involved and very subtle. But this is a nice time to tell you a story about Roy Glauber. So does anyone know what the Ig Nobel Prizes are?
Yeah.
Do you know who sweeps up when all the people throw paper airplanes on the stage and like rotten tomatoes and things like that? So until he died, Roy Glauber manned the broom. So he was a really cool guy. And my other Roy Glauber story is that, you know, I was at BU for 36 years. At the end of each year, we had a fancy schmancy colloquium to try and invite a Nobel Prize winner. And so one year we got to invite Roy Glauber. Actually, it was before he won the Nobel Prize. And because I was department chairman at the time, one of the things I get to do is I can sit at the grown-up table with like the mucky muck. So, you know, I'm sitting beside Roy Glauber. I didn't know who he was. And so we sit down at the table, you know, I see that the guy is sitting beside me, place name is Roy Glauber. And so he sits down and I say, hi, I'm Sid Redner. I'm the department chairman. He says, hi, I'm Roy Glauber. He said, Roy Glauber, you're my hero. You solved the one-dimensional Ising model. I thought it was such a beautiful paper. I'm so in awe, blah, blah, blah. You know, I went on and on. And oh, that piece of shit, I didn't, you know, I couldn't care less. You know, I was more into like nonlinear optics. So he won a Nobel Prize for nonlinear optics. So this was a throwaway for him. Anyways, that gives you a sense of like how smart the guy was. Anyways, let's solve this. So solution. Ah, crap. I've got one more piece of chalk I haven't yet wrecked. Solution. But I'm going to do it. I'm going to cheat in the continuum limit. And so if you want to compare the complexity of this continuum solution with the exact discrete solution, I invite you to read Roy Glauber's paper in a 1965 issue of Journal of Mathematical Physics. But in the continuum limit, and also I'm going to also look at the case at t equals 0, which is gamma equals 1. So lots of caveats here. So, oh, and by the way, I see that there's one slight typo in my this guy here. This is GK, not G1. Sorry. Whoops, wrong one. Okay, so solution of the continuum limit. So what I argue is that in this limit, we're going to get GK dot is equal to minus, we're going to get GK plus 1 minus 2GK minus GK minus 1. And this is nothing more than the discrete second derivative. And so in the continuous limit, this goes to g dgk by dt is equal to d second g by dx squared. And again, with the boundary conditions that g at t equals 0 is, sorry, initial condition g at k and t equals 0 is equal to delta of k, and g of k equals 0 and t is equal to 1. So, I mean, physically, what that looks like is that if I'm plotting as a function of position x, g, so g starts out with like a spike at the origin, which is I'm perfectly self-correlated. Let me, I'll answer you in just a second. And everybody else is completely uncorrelated. And so what's going to happen is that this correlation will gradually spread through the system. And as we're going to see, this is one here, that for early time, it looks something like this. For later time, it looks something like that. And this will spread. And the rate of spread scales the square root of t. And that will be how the correlations spread through the system. Your question.
Yeah, I was wondering, is that plus 2k minus 1?
Say that again? Oh, I'm sorry. Plus. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Well, it turns out that this problem, we can actually make it a little bit easier by doing the following little trick, which is let me define C is equal to 1 minus G. Let's just look at that one. I mean, it looks like I'm doing nothing. I'm just subtracting a constant from it. But it turns out that, so we're going to solve dC dt is equal to d second C by dx squared. And then I have C of k t equals 0 is equal to 0, right? And C of 0 and t is equal to 0 as well. Sorry, I got this backwards. It was 1. So the thing is that this initial condition says I'm perfectly correlated at the origin, no correlations out here. When I take 1 minus that, I'll get that I have a concentration one everywhere except at the origin where the concentration is zero. So in this case, if I'm plotting as a function of x, c, so I'm starting off with the concentration equals one, and basically at this point, I have forced the concentration to be zero. So I can think of this as diffusion. So this is random walkers diffusing on a one-dimensional lattice with the cliff at the origin. When you hit the cliff, you go off the cliff and you die. And so clearly, the concentration field will look something like this. And as we're going to see, this spread again is like square root of t. And so once we have the concentration field here, we take one minus it to get the correlation function. Yes?
Why did you assume that your dg dt is equal to d squared g dx squared?
Because I'm taking the continuous limit of this object. This is the discrete second difference, which is second derivative.
I'm a little confused.
Wait. Go ahead.
Should that be 1 minus delta k? C of k at t equals to 0?
C of k at t equals 0. Well, here we had that g of k at t equals 0. It equals 0 everywhere except at the origin. So if I take 1 minus that, I'll get 1 everywhere and 0 at the origin. And then, but at the origin, it's 0 anyway, so it doesn't matter. So yes?
What is the meaning of the first initial condition?
What is the meaning of what?
First initial condition.
This one here? Well, that I'm perfectly self-correlated. I said that incorrectly. This initial condition means that I have no correlations initially. So I'm preparing the system where I just sort of drop my spins at random, equally probably plus and minus, which means that there's no correlations between neighboring spins. Yes?
So I don't quite understand why it's d squared g by dx squared. Like,
d squared?
The second derivative would be in k, right?
This guy here?
Yes. Yeah, because the k's don't mean like position. As in it's not a...
Well, no. So what I'm doing to take the continuous limit, I'm saying, I'm saying k is going to, this is like x, and this one is like delta x. And then I'm taking the limit as delta x goes to 0. So all you do is do a Taylor series expansion of these things, and you'll find that the first derivative goes away, and the second derivative exactly gives me this, and the zeroth order terms exactly cancel.
So are we saying that g is a function of x? Or?
Yeah, so I'm doing this. Here I had g as a function of discrete index k, which is the separation. Now I'm saying let k go to a continuous variable, x, and let the 1 go to a continuous variable, delta x, which goes to 0. Okay, so how about I stop for like 4 minutes, and then I'll solve this. I leave you in suspense. I'll solve it, and then... so you can leave, stay, I'll ask questions, but I'm not going to speak for the next 4 minutes except to answer questions. Yes?
How did you draw that diagram?
Which one? This one here?
Yeah.
Yeah, so what I'm trying to argue is that the initial condition, what the system looks like at t equals zero, nobody is correlated with anybody else except you're correlated with yourself. So that means if nobody is correlated, that means that as a function of distance, if I vote Trump, then I ask somebody in the back of the classroom, who do you vote for? I have no idea. Was it Trump or Biden or whatever? Whereas here, I know that, well, I voted for Trump, even though I can't vote in the United States because I'm a Canadian citizen. But anyways, so I'm perfectly correlated with myself. So I know I voted for Trump. What?
At heart, you are with Trump.
Oh, you can vault. Yes. Okay. Yes.
Okay, and then?
And then, yeah, but it's just that at the origin, I get 1 because I'm perfectly self-correlated.
What about the delta t?
Yeah, so all I'm trying to argue, well, we're going to see from the solution, is that if I am a dedicated Trumpist and we're all at zero energy, so we want to try to minimize conflict. And so if I say you should vote for Trump, but you say I'm a Bidenist, but if I keep saying and only saying forever that vote Trump, eventually, you'll give in because you want to lower the energy, the tension between us, and then you tell the next person vote Trump, and eventually they give in, and so the correlations will spread through the system in that way. And the rate at which it spreads is like square root of t. Yes?
Geometrical interpretation for the g, k, when k is not 1, but like higher.
Well, I mean, the thing is that let's look at, say, G2, just for the sake of argument. So that's going to be sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 2, sigma, well, actually, let me be more general. So this is sigma I plus 1.
Okay,
sorry. G2. So this is sigma I plus 2. Right? But I can write that as sigma I plus 1, sigma I plus 1, sigma I plus 2. Let me think for a second.
Sorry, I'm still confused on the drawing.
Yeah, hang on a second. I'm still thinking about his question. Just give me a second. I mean, I'm trying to see if whether it says something about density of domain walls that are separated by a distance of two. I'm not sure I see it yet. I mean, but I think somehow, in you know, a correlation function of size k says something about the density of domain walls that are separated by a given distance. But I'm going to have to think about that. I'm maybe there is a simple answer and maybe there isn't. I'm just not sure. But thank you for the question. Yes.
I still don't know what the different lines in the diagram are.
So this was at t equals zero. This is at early time. And this guy is at later time. And so this curve gradually develops as a function of time until it you know.
Why is it changing like that?
Well, we're going to solve this in like 2 minutes, and then you'll see. You had a question, yes.
It looks like on this graph.
What's the what?
It looks on this graph like the first, the second boundary condition isn't applying because at x equals zero, g is not one.
No, but this is sort of like one. You can think of this as like a source of fluid that you're always inputting in the system at the rate one, and then this fluid is somehow going to fill up the rest of the system. But it.
But with x equals zero.
At x equals zero only.
Always one, right?
That's right.
So it's a discontinuous?
You know what? Sorry. God dang. Let me clean up this picture because I see I drew it dyslexic. Let's try again. Gk as a, okay, let's call it gx now, as a function of x. So it's one at the origin. And it starts off zero everywhere else. So that's what happens at early time. So this happens at t equals zero. At some early time, it's going to look something like this. And then at some later time, it's going to look something like that. And then it just gradually, you know, fills in and so until you get to one. So I'm sorry, that must have been confusing. So sorry about drawing it upside down. Okay, so let me wait for another minute. Anything else before I? Yep.
When you're writing transition equation or something, transition rate, why are you justified to take a 2 outside and
put? What do you mean here? So ask your question again, say it louder.
Why are you justified to take 2 out of the tangent?
No, the reason why is that, you know, I started with, you know, I started with no 2 here and no 2 here.
Yeah.
But the point is that if I put a 2 here and I put a 2 here, first thing is that doesn't change anything. That's point number one.
Huh?
Right? That doesn't change anything.
Does it help?
No, because it's all in, well, okay. Crap. What do I do here? Okay. I made a really stupid mistake here. So let me, whoops, wrong one. Okay, let's try this again. Got myself too fancy. So here is tanh. So, okay, we agree that's the starting point, right? Okay, so what I'm going to do now, which does not change anything, is I'm going to divide by 2 here and multiply by 2 here. Uh-huh. And now I'm going to call gamma hyperbolic tangent of 2 beta g. So we agree this hasn't changed anything, right? So now I have tangent of 2 beta j, and this variable here takes the values plus 1, minus 1, or 0, and that's it. And then that's how I get to here, where this gamma is equal to hyperbolic tangent of 2 beta j. So I'm sorry, like I wrote the 2 here. I should have written the 2 here. So I screw up. Thank you for keeping me honest. Okay, so what I want to do now is let's solve this equation. And all right, so let's write the solution. And you know, again, when you're dealing with a partial differential equation of this kind, there's lots of different ways to solve it. And you know, you could do Fourier transform, Laplace transform. In this particular case, because this is defined on a semi-infinite interval, so we don't have translational invariance, it suggests doing the Laplace transform. So I'm going to apply the Laplace transform to the equation. And so when I Laplace transform it, I'm going to get SC, where this is, you know, should be like tilde to denote the Laplace transform, but I'm never going to write these because I hate glopping up my notation, minus the initial condition, which is minus 1. Because at t equals 0, I have it equals to 1. Start with an initial concentration 1 everywhere. It's equal to d second c by x squared. And I'll write a c double prime because it's no longer a partial differential equation because there's only one variable I'm differentiating with respect to. And so how do we solve this equation? So there's two things. One is you first solve the homogeneous equation, which is just this. And so this is just exponential solutions. And then we solve the homogeneous equation, or the particular equation, which is the solution of this guy. And then the general solution is the sum of these two things. So the particular solution is clearly C is 1 over S. So there's going to be C particular is equal to 1 over S. And C homogeneous, so that's equal to A e to the square root of S over dx plus B e to the minus the square root of S over dx. But this part we can just throw away right away because it blows up at x going to infinity. And so that's not an acceptable solution. So our general solution is a combination of the particular solution plus a homogeneous solution that satisfies the boundary condition at x equals 0. And so the solution is C of x and s is equal to 1 over s, 1 minus e to the minus the square root of S over dx. So that's the solution. And now we have to invert this Laplace transform. And now I don't know how to do the inversion of the Laplace transform off the top of my head. But you know, there's tables of inverse Laplace transforms. And so it turns out that C of x and t is equal to the error function of x divided by the square root of dt. That's the answer. And the interesting feature about the error function, and you know, again, like, you know, you in the Mathematica generation probably know this, you know, because you all just plug everything into Mathematica. In the limit, as t goes to infinity, this goes to 1 over the square root of t. So it says that at any given point in space, the concentration is gradually going down, and it goes down to 0 at a rate 1 over the square root of t. And so that corresponds to the problem of, like, if I start with, like, a gas of random walkers in the positive half line with the cliff at 0, because of diffusion, they gradually fall over the cliff. By the way, I guess in my colloquium on Wednesday, I'm going to talk about this in a little bit more detail. So if that interests you, it'll be something I'll say something about. Anyways, and so you get that the concentration field starts off at 1 and gradually, you know, flattens out, which corresponds to the spread of correlations in the complementary problem of the correlation function, which was 1 minus c. And so this gives you essentially the solution of the correlation function in the one-dimensional easing model at zero temperature. So in the case of the temperature is positive, then you actually allow the possibility that domain walls can exist in a long time limit. And that corresponds to, like, this correlation function not decaying all the way to zero, going all the way to one, but just going to an equilibrium value. And that's a much more complicated affair that I'm not going to discuss, because the one-dimensional case, in some sense, the most appealing because of this natural correspondence with this reaction of A plus A going to nothing and plus diffusion. Okay, so that is the end of my story of the one-dimensional easing model dynamics. So any questions about this? Yes.
Simple, like what is D there and
what is, oh, sorry. Sorry. I'm so used to solving this with a diffusion coefficient. This is the diffusion coefficient, which we haven't defined here. The diffusion coefficient in this model is 1. So this is 1. So this is 1. Okay, so that's all that happens. Yeah, sorry about that.
Also, what is ERF here?
Pardon me?
ERF.
Yes. This is the error function. Mm-hmm. So, you know, error function of x. This is defined to be like the square root from 0 to x, e to the minus t squared dt. And, you know, somebody maybe know the answer better than I do. It's like, I think it's 2 over root pi. Yeah, I think that's the definition of the error function. But I might have got this like upside down or backwards or something. So check. Has someone checked me on it yet? No. You guys are sure. Okay. So error function is one of the classic, you know, special functions in mathematical physics. I mean, it's like Bessel function, Legendre function. There's error function.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Pardon me?
That's exactly it.
Oh, good. Okay. Nice. I actually do remember something. Okay. So anyways, I'm now going to change subjects completely and introduce a new topic. And so this is sort of, I guess, is the fourth component of the course, which is sort of interacting particle systems or like particle system dynamics. And the first example that I want to describe is the so-called birth-death reaction. Process. So imagine for the moment that instead of us being people, we're all bacteria. And bacteria, we split and divide at some rate that depends on how much food we have. Well, let's assume there's a constant input of food. And so we sort of on our own, we decide to make a copy of ourselves and we continue dividing. But then, you know, like we could starve to death. And so we die at some rate. So in the birth-death process, we can imagine a particle of type A just spontaneously goes to A plus A with some birth rate lambda. And similarly, I could be living, and with some rate mu, I could die. So that defines the birth-death process. And the question that I want to ask is, well, what is the dynamics of this process? If I start with one particle initially, how many particles will it be at some later time? What is the distribution of the number of particles? Can the system go extinct? What are the conditions by which it goes extinct? There's lots of simple questions you can ask. And also, you know, you see this as a very generic, paradigmatic example of like a interacting particle system. And one thing to note is that if lambda is bigger than mu, then we'll have like a Malthusian explosion because the birth rate exceeds the death rate. So then in each generation, there'll be more people, and they're all giving birth. So I have like the number of people blowing up exponentially. On the other hand, if mu is bigger than lambda, then that means that more people die per unit time than are born, and so the population will disappear. So the interesting case turns out to be the case lambda equals mu. And so let's write the rate equation for the number of people as a function of time. So n is the number of organisms alive, number of particles, just say. Let's now make them non-anthropomorphic, number of particles. And n average will be the average number of particles.
So
So in one particular realization of the process, I might have 63, in another one I might have 57, I might have a whole distribution number of particles, and n average is meant to average over all possible realizations of the process. And so the first thing that you might be interested in looking at is what is the behavior of the average number of particles. So what is n dot doing? Well, each particle gives birth at the rate lambda. And so on average, I'll get lambda times n average. But then each particle dies at the rate mu, so minus mu n average. And if mu is equal to lambda, then I'll get 0 for mu equals lambda. So it doesn't tell us very much. So it's the same thing as like a flipping a coin. If I ask like how many heads do I get after a million flips, I ask what is the average number of heads I get. We all know it's 500,000, but at least so we knew that from the beginning of the game. So that doesn't tell us very much. Or if we ask for the difference in the number of heads and tails, that'll be 0 throughout the entire process. But we know that actually what's more interesting is the Gaussian probability distribution, which tells us something about the fluctuations in the system. So looking at averages is not terribly helpful, because what we really want to do is look at the distribution itself. So let me look at Pn of t. So this is defined to be the probability that there exists n particles at time t. This will be our fundamental quantity. And let's look at what this is. And in fact, I'm going to do this even simpler. Let's look at the case there's only birth, no death. So we know that the population explodes exponentially and quickly. So for birth only, and let's suppose that the birth rate with lambda equals 1 and mu equals 0. So for its only birth, that says that the average number of particles grows, if I start with a single particle initially, this will go like e to the t. So what could be simpler? The population is exploding. But as we're going to see, if we look at Pn of t, the probability that there are n particles in the system, we will see that the most likely event, the highest probability event, is one particle. So even though the average number of particles is after a time of, you know, 10 to the 10th is like ridiculously large, the most likely event is there only one particle in the system. How could that possibly be? What?
Yeah.
Yeah, how could that possibly be? What? What? Yeah, how could it possibly be? So what we're going to do is we're going to solve for Pn of t.
What happens if you don't get an explosion?
You know, stay tuned. You'll see why. So what we need to do is we need to look at the probability, we need to look at the time rate of change of this probability distribution. So actually, let me go back over here for the case of the birth-death process. Let me write it down, Pn of t dot, and then we'll specialize to the case of no death. And let me do this for the case where lambda is equal to mu. Just that's the simplest case, and it's the most interesting case. And let me choose lambda equals mu equals 1, so I have less junk to write in my equation. So how does probability that there are n particles in the system change? Well, there's several ways it can change. One is I could start with, you know, if I say n is 1,000, I could start with 999 particles. One of them gives birth, and it happens with rate 1. And since there's 999 particles, the total birth rate is 999 times 1. So the birth rate is proportional to the number of particles of, you know, or it's proportional to this 999 times the probability that there are 999 particles. But if I have 1,001 particles, any one of them can die with a rate proportional to 1. So the total rate of death is 1,001. So it's n plus 1, pn plus 1. But then if I have 1,000 particles, either I could, one of us could die, or one of us could give birth. Each one of those happens independently. And so there's minus 2n pn. So this is my fundamental equation that describes the evolution of the probability distribution. And notice that it kind of looks like a random walk, but it's just that the step length depends on n. So you can think of this as a one-dimensional random walk process, But the further out you are in n space, the further to the right, the more particles there are, the faster you're stepping, because there's more people to either give birth or death. And so it's a very strange type of random walk process, because it's speeding up the more particles there are in the system. So that's sort of a random walk interpretation.
Sorry, Sid, can you explain it 2n again?
The 2n, because if I have 1,000 particles, any one of us could die, but also any one of us could give birth. And since each happens with the rate 1, so the total exit rate of twice times the number of particles, because one exit is by birth and one exit is by death.
Lambda plus mu.
Exactly. It would have been lambda plus mu. Here you would have had a lambda term here, lambda plus mu, and here a mu term. Yeah, in the general case. And I invite you to solve that in the general case. But over here, so what we then have is much simpler, n minus 1, pn minus 1, minus npn. Okay, so I'd like to solve this equation. And now I'm going to be my first recycle event. So there's two ways there's actually many ways to solve this equation, but let me introduce to you two ways, the hard way and the elegant way. And you can choose which one you prefer after the fact. So one way is solve sequentially. And when you're confronted with systems of rate equations of this type, sometimes it's a reasonable starting point. Let's start with the very first equation, p1 dot. And so if I just copy down from over there, well, there's no way that if I have 0 particles, I can give birth, because there's nobody to give birth to. So there's no gain term, but there's a loss term, minus 1 p1. So equals. And also, let me choose the initial condition. As usual, I'm going to start with a system with 1 particle in the system. So even I can solve this equation. This is p1 of t is equal to p1 of 0, e to the minus t, which is equal to e to the minus t. So now let's look at p2 dot. So we have a gain term, because we have a gain term from 1. 1 particle can give birth, and that creates 2 particles. So that happens with the rate p1 minus, and then there's a loss term, minus 2 p2. And again, I get the sense, this is a generational thing, is that this is a, system, it's a first order differential equation, and you can solve it by the integrating factor. When I say the word integrating factor, does everyone feel comfortable?
No.
Some people do, some people don't. So if you take a freshman differential equations class, the first thing you learn is how to solve equations by the integrating factor. And so this guy, the way you solve it is you could say, well, this is p2 dot plus 2p2 is equal to p1. Multiply both of these equations by e to the 2t. And then what you get here is p2 e to the 2t, the whole thing dot. Notice if I multiplying through by e to the 2t, then I get p2 e to the 2t. And when I differentiate this guy, there's 2 terms, p2 dot, and then when I differentiate e to the 2t, it brings down the 2, and that's e to the 2t, and so that's equal to p1 e to the 2t. And so what I'm going to get, that p2 e to the 2t, and p1, what we saw was e to the minus t, so this is e to the t. So when I integrate this guy, I get e to the t minus 1. And so finally, I get from this p2 of t is equal to e to the minus t, 1 minus e to the minus t. So that's the solution for p2. And then you can do it, well, okay, now I have p2. I can write the equation for p3 because it only involves p2. And you turn the crank and turn, and you'll get the answer. And so if you want to try it yourself, to do the next one and maybe see a pattern, I invite you to do that. But what I want to do instead is I want to show you the generating function solution, because first of all, it's infinitely elegant, and you get everything in a single shot. And so let me ask, in the tutorial, were you shown like the generating function solution for the Fibonacci sequence?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So I'm going to use exactly that same device to solve this system of equations. And again, you might say, well, how did I know to even use a generating function? Well, the point is that if you go back and look over here and look in the continuous limit, this sort of looks like a first order equation in time with some spatial dependence that's only involving the half line. And so that suggests in the continuous limit, I should use Laplace transform. And the generating function is nothing more than the discrete version of the Laplace transform. So here I'm going to use the generating function solution. So I'm going to define P of z is equal to summation n equals 0 to infinity of Pn z to the n. And notice that this looks very much like the Laplace transform. Because if I say, you know, note, if I take z is defined as e to the minus s, then this would look like summation n equals 0 to infinity of Pn e to the minus ns. And now suppose that for some reason I want n very large. And for large n, the sum will go to a continuous integral, and then I replace n by t. And so this sort of looks like p of t e to the minus st integral dt. So this is just to try and show you that there is this natural correspondence between the generating function and the Laplace transform. OK, so I'm not going to finish this in 12 minutes, but we'll see. Well, actually, maybe I have like 14 minutes. So let's take our equation, Pn dot is equal to, so I have n minus 1, Pn minus 1, minus npn. I'm going to take this entire equation, multiply everything by z to the power n, and sum from n equals 1 to infinity. But let's see what we get out of all of this. So on the left-hand side, we just have the time derivative of the generating function. So the left-hand side is just going to be nothing more than dp dt as a function now of z and t. And I'm writing it as partial derivative because our generating function, you know, since pn of t had a t argument here, this should be a function of two variables, z and t. So it's partial derivative. OK, let's look at this term, because this is a little bit easier to deal with. So let me maybe do a little worksheet over here.
Didn't you have also a zeroth term?
Why?
Because your sum for the generating function is from n equal to 0, but the...
No, it's from, sorry. 1. I'm going to define it this way, because if I have zero particles, there's nothing to talk about because it's like the vacuum. There's no dynamics there. So it should start at 1. Sorry about that mistake. OK, so anyway, so let's look at the second term on the right, because that's simpler to deal with. So what we have is summation n equals 1 to infinity. And so I have n pn z to the power n. And perhaps you've seen this trick before, but like to bring down the factor of n, what I can do is treat n z as a fake parameter that I'll differentiate with respect to, and then I get the same thing. So I argue that this is nothing more than z d by dz summation n equals 1 to infinity of pn z to the power n. So you see, if I differentiate with respect to z, first of all, n is a function of time, not as a function of z. Now will come a factor n, z to the n minus 1, but the z restores the power of n. So this last term here is nothing more than minus z dp by dz. Let's look at the first term. Well, that one's a little, we have to be a little bit more careful because it's a summation from n equals 1 to infinity of n minus 1, pn minus 1, z to the power n. So first thing is, let me do this. So I'm being a little bit lazy. And let me just focus attention with everything that's sitting in here. So this So now here we have, you know, we have n minus 1, n minus 1, n minus 1. Let's call this guy m. And so when n goes from 1 to infinity, well, the first term, when n is equal to 1, if m is n minus 1, the first term will go from m equals 0 to infinity. So this is nothing more than 0 summation from m equals 0, m. Let me make it look like an m. M equals 0 to infinity. So we have m dm z to the power m. But notice that the term m equals 0 is multiplied by m 0. It's not even there. So in fact, we could replace this by m equals 1, not change anything. But now this is just the same as we had over here. It's nothing more than z d by dz of the generating function. But there's one more z sitting out in front. So this is nothing more than z squared dp by dz. And so basically, what we're going to get here then is nothing more than z squared minus 1, z squared minus z dp by dz. So we have transformed our original equation, which was an infinite set of coupled linear differential time, you know, differential equations, into one. Notice it's, we changed from one infinite number of equations to one equation, one partial differential equation. And if you do anything involving population dynamics, this always, always happens. So even though this might seem like black magic at some level, it's a standard trick to transform systems of master equations like this into a partial differential equation. And so the thing is that we now have to solve this partial differential equation. Looks scary, doesn't it? A little bit. But it turns out that, you know, if you've taken a course in partial differential equations, this equation is actually a very generic form. It's what's called the wave equation. It's the wave equation in disguise. And because it's the wave equation in disguise, we can solve it. And so has anyone heard about the method of characteristics? OK, so if you've seen method of characteristics, it should look very familiar. But if you haven't seen it, let me show you the method of characteristics for this example, because this is truly one of the simplest examples of how of it in action. And I guess I'll just stay here. So the idea here is that, wow, the term on the right, that looks like, I don't know, it looks like, I don't know what to say about it. But the idea here is, let me now define the new variable y by the following thing. Dy is equal to dz divided by z minus 1. Let's just define that. Fine. And then what we get for our differential equation is dp by dt is equal to dp by dy. Doesn't that look a lot simpler? And this is the one-dimensional wave equation. And the solution for this, solution, or now p as a function of y and t, not no longer z and t, because this is, we've transformed coordinates. So this is a function of only y and t. This is equal to f of y plus t, where f is any function. You know, maybe when you've seen, like, in undergraduate, you know, wave mechanics, you learn about the solution of the wave equation. And when you write down the wave equation, you'll find that the solution is any function at all. That, and the way you determine this function is by the initial condition. So in principle, this differential equation has f, which is a function of this combination of variables that will solve this equation for any value of the function f under the sun. And is any function in general. But is determined by the initial condition. So again, IC is my generic abbreviation for initial condition. Okay, so what is my initial condition? Did I mention it over here? I don't remember if I did or not. So let's take over here for our initial condition that Pn of t equals 0 is equal to delta n1. That is, I start my system with a single particle. And I want to ask, well, how does a single particle grow as a function of time? So the initial condition is that, which means that P of z, the generating function at t equals 0, which is a summation, n equals 1 to infinity of Pn of t at t equals 0, z to the power n, well, that's equal to z, because there's only one term in the sum, only that one term. So that says that, so at t equals 0, we have p y t equals 0, which is equal to our unknown function f at t equals 0, which is some function of y. And but the thing is that we know the initial condition equals to z. But this is bad because here it's z, here it's y. We need to express z as a function of y to actually find out what is y at the initial time and then basically solve the problem. So let's find out the relationship between y and z. So dy equal to dz. And so I do a partial fraction decomposition. And so this is going to be, I guess it's, there's, where is it going to be? Maybe it's here. T minus 1, z. That's the other way around. Z. No, t minus 1. Ah. If someone knows the answer faster than me, that's good.
Z plus 1 over z minus 1.
Say again?
1 over z minus 1 minus 1 over z.
Yeah.
This is right? Z, but then I have, so I have z minus, oh, yeah. Oh, God dang. Okay, thank you. Okay, so I do the partial fraction decomposition. And so from this, I can find y is equal to logarithm of z minus 1 over z.
What about any sort of like constant of integration? How come we?
Good point. Excellent point. But the thing is that that is going to be handled by the initial condition. So yes, there may be a constant of integration here, but we're going to figure it out from the initial condition. So anyways, this is equal. So we have e to the y is equal to 1 minus 1 over z. And so z, so e to the y minus 1 is equal to minus 1 over z. So z is equal to minus 1 divided by e to the y minus, did I do something wrong here? I feel, I somehow, I don't like the signs, but it seems, does it, is this right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you could put the minus sign on the bottom and make it 1 over 1 minus.
Oh, yeah, let's do that. 1 divided by 1 minus e to the y. Okay, so this thing is equal to 1 divided by 1 minus e to the y. So that says that p y of t is equal to f of our same function, but now with a new argument, y plus t. And so this is equal to 1 divided by 1 minus e to the y plus t. So that's my solution. But in this form, it's not terribly useful because we have it in this weird variable y, but we saw that when we introduced the generating function, we wrote it as a function of z, but now we can use the same relation to write y as a function of z. And so this guy is equal to then 1 divided by 1 minus e to the t, and then I have e to the y. E to the y is z minus 1 over z. Wow, I got one more minute. Let's see if I can do this. So this is z, z, minus e to the t z plus e to the t. Let me write this as z. Funny when I say something and write something different. And I'll write it as, I'll factor out e to the minus t, and so I'll get 1 minus z, 1 minus e to the minus t. Wow, I even have the right answer. So that's the generating function. And now, even I can expand this in a Taylor series. So this is going to be z e to the minus t, summation from n equals 1 to infinity of z to the power n, 1 minus e to the minus t to the power n. And the coefficient of pn, the value of pn is the coefficient of order n in all of this thing here. And so we get pn of t is equal to e to the minus t, 1 minus e to the minus t to the power n minus 1. That's the answer. I know that the very first time I saw somebody derive something like this, I was just completely boggled. It's like, wow. You see that there's this whole apparatus of the generating function approach allows you to solve an infinite set of equations by solving a single partial differential equation. There's a little bit of trickery in transforming variables and going from the z variable to the y variable and back again, so that you have to, like, you just have to play with it several times to feel comfortable with it. But the point here is that we have now the full solution. And I'm now out of time, but what I'll do next time is I'll begin by discussing some of the amazing features of the solution. It looks very simple, but it hides behind it some very beautiful mysteries. Namely, that there are huge fluctuations in this system of bacteria, so that even though the average number is growing exponentially in time, the fluctuations are also growing exponentially in time, which means that any observation of such a system is useless because it doesn't tell you anything about the average behavior of the system. So that's will be for next time. That's it.
So at each step, if you look at the system, you don't see.
Well, there's no such thing as step. There's just because there's everything is giving birth at some rate. So you just say, look at that system at some particular time.
Okay. At any particular time,
right.
You see that the system is blowing up.
Well, I'd see that the number of particles on average is growing exponentially. But the thing is, if I look at the distribution, we're going to see next time, what is the width of this distribution? The width of this distribution is also growing exponentially with time. So in fact, even if you plot this thing, or just plot it, pn is a function of n at any particular time. But it's only discrete values, but I'll draw continuous. It looks something like that. So the peak at 1, yeah. What's the deal with that? But the thing is that it extends out to the other side of the universe over here, so it's like incredibly wide. And because it's so wide, the average value is still growing exponentially, even though the most likely event is that the particles are lazy and nobody ever decided to, like, divide. It's really bizarre. Yes?
I have a question. When you're doing the last step, when you actually
here.
Turn that expression into the original, like, form of sum.
Yeah.
The limit goes from n equals to 2 to n.
No, because there's a term here with 1 power of z.
Yeah, so if you want to turn it into original form, it has to be.
Oh, sorry. Because this sum starts at n equals 0. Yeah, sorry. All right, well. That's it for today. I'm guessing that some of this was a little bit mind-blowing, but good. That's good.